You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
It was indeed the news and Morning Glory. Thank you very much to the lovely Hannah Ross. You are now tuned into The Wire for the 13th of October. That's right, it's the 13th. Still nothing, is there, Laura, on the Parliament?
No, I'm waiting and being impatient, as every single
other New Zealander.
In the
but that's all right, because other things are going on, and we've been working hard to find you some good listening. So, first up, Laura talked with Auckland University Crackham magazine's sports columnist Mark Fullerton and illustrations editor Isabel Gledhill on the upcoming referendum that may result in funding cuts for the university's paper. Next up, we talk the latest trend, veganism. Why should we consider a plant-based diet? Following that, of course, we chat with Nicole Wedding from Radio Adelaide, so we don't forget what's happening across the ditch. After that, producer Laura talked to Alan Johnson, a senior policy and analyst at the Salvation Army's Social Policy and Parliamentary Unit, on the 14 Hours Homeless Challenge that starts today. And finally, we've got something coming from producer Connor. It's exciting things, but he's quickly editing it and finalising that for some good listening for you. So stay tuned for that. Remember, if you've got anything you'd like to add throughout the show, tukupatuhi mai, give us a text on 5395 or why am I, call us on 309 3879.
The upcoming referendum at Auckland University has included the question, should the Crackham magazine section editors continue to be paid? I spoke with Crackham sports columnist Mark Fullerton and illustrations editor Isabel Gledhill on the upcoming referendum. I started by asking them to explain what they do for the paper.
Well, I write quizzes and a sports column, and I've written a number of features throughout the year, and yeah, just general helping out around the place, yeah.
So I'm the visual arts editor, which is the first year, at least in a while, that they've had that role. So I, once the articles come in, I delegate them to our team of illustrators, and more often than not do one or two of the illustrations myself, because, you know, we're on a limited amount of time. Yeah.
The question for the referendum is, should the Crackham section editors continue to be paid? What's your response to this?
Of course. I mean, we fought so hard last year to get this pay put in place, and it's minimal as it is, and to take it away is a slap in the face to just the amount of work that goes into the magazine.
Yeah, I know personally I wouldn't have been able to do my, like, justify doing my job at Crackham with the time it takes up. If I was getting paid nothing at all, I would have had to go and find another job. For the visual arts editor next year, I think they would also really struggle if they were not getting compensated for it at all, and the quality of the magazine would suffer.
How many hours would you say you put into Crackham in a week?
I mean, it obviously varies a bit, because we only publish it during the weeks that uni is actually on. So I might just spend like an hour and a half or something doing emails and stuff in one of those off weeks. But it can be up to like 6 or 8 hours in a week where I end up doing a lot of the illustrations myself, and my pay is nowhere near like minimum wage for those kind of times. Yeah.
Do you have any suspects for who might have propositioned this question?
It has to be someone on the AUSA executive, because outside the AUSA executive, no one would know that crack and pay happens. I mean, this is the first year. It's not like it's an ongoing issue that the student body gets rarked up about all the time. So it has to be someone in the know, and it's certainly not anyone from our end.
So previously, AUSA has attempted to strip your funding. Do you have more detail?
So at the start of the year, AUSA, the executive, decided that they wanted to pay themselves for the year, which is fair enough, because they also do a lot of work. But the discussion started with, Crackham is being paid, why aren't we being paid? And that kind of led to, should we take away Crackham pay? And by the time those discussions happened, the contracts with the Crackham section editors had already been signed. So that was untouchable, which was, again, a bit of a contentious issue. But if AUSA broke their contracts, then that's just a whole new legal problem to deal with. So they set about chopping and changing the entire AUSA budget to find, what was it, about $50,000?
Yeah.
That they needed in order to pay themselves for the year. And, of course, they went after the Crackham, what do you call it, the resources budget.
So that's what we would, the money we would spend if we wanted to have like an end of semester celebration, or if someone needed to do like a lot of travel to write a particular story, we would reimburse them out of that. Yeah.
So last year, again, that last year was the first time that we had a resources budget. And, you know, it was fairly big, but half of that we actually spent paying our staff. And so this year they decided, okay, so we've already set aside money to pay the AUSA editors, so we'll cut the resource budget. And that was fine. Everyone was okay with that, because what they ended up giving us was about what we'd spent on resources last year. But then when they came to find money to pay themselves, they cut it even further, and they didn't tell us. And it was just by accident that Isabel was having coffee with a friend on the exec, and she mentioned, like, oh, how are you guys going now that your budget's been cut? Which was news.
Yeah.
So we had to go to the meeting and argue our way into getting our $1,500 restored.
So you formerly worked with the AUSA executive?
I was the admin vice president last year, and the culture and arts officer the year before that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you have worked with Crackham while you were doing that?
Yeah, so I did view illustrations the year before last while I was admin vice president, and I got to know Mark and Caitlin because they came to our executive meetings and stuff. Yeah.
So you understand AUSA's perspective. Could you give it a little bit more context?
Yeah, I do understand. Like Mark said, they also work really hard, and it would be cool if everyone could be paid. I have no problem with that, although the way that they're going about it is just a bit weird and dodgy. I think the difference with AUSA and Crackham is, with Crackham there's an actual magazine that you have to put out. There's like a tangible result. So in AUSA, like, someone might be a bit lazy with how they approach their position, and there'll be other people to pick up the slack, and it might go kind of unnoticed. With Crackham, if there's, you know, four blank pages in the magazine, that's pretty obvious.
And I guess I'll end with, how do you believe Crackham has a positive effect on the student body?
Well, it's the voice. It's the voice of the students. And I think AUSA, whoever it is that's put forward this question, I think it's an incredibly cynical move on their part to bring forward this question at the same time as they've brought forward their own, the exec should be paid, because clearly that question's coming from the exec as well. So they know that Crackham's going to fight to keep their section editor pay. And then they can use that to say, oh, Crackham is fighting for their section editors to be paid, therefore the exec should be paid. But we don't have a problem with the exec being paid. It's fine, they do work and they deserve to be paid. What we do have a problem with is backdating it 12 weeks when there's been no system put in place to actually guarantee that they've done those 10 hours a week, those 12 weeks, and to be paying someone $17 an hour when AUSA exec hours, attendance at events counts. So what's going to happen is we're going to be paying $17 an hour for someone to have gone to an erotic fan fiction reading. And it's ridiculous. Like, we put out a tangible product. We have to do it. If we don't put out the magazine, like Isabel said, four blank pages, people are going to notice. And it's really got to me.
And I'd also like to add that the influence of Crackham, you know, we would all love for it to be more widely read. We think we could do that with, if we had like a better website and stuff, but this is all in the hands of AUSA, who basically don't let us become a, how do you say, they're, that, they're, like a bigger media company, because we can't update our own website and stuff.
I feel like we've been neglected for so long. And admittedly, Kraken did have a bit of a shit period in the early 2010s, but it's on the up and we can't get any better if we're constantly being hamstrung by things like this. We've finally got this initiative in place where we can pay people who do work for us. And now AUSA, who's meant to support the student body and the student voice, is trying to come along. Well, not AUSA, the referendum is trying to, you know, pull the rug out from under us. I mean, what? There's not much we can do if we're just being
under-resourced
at every turn.
Yeah.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was indeed Isabel Gledhill and Mark Fullerton from Auckland University's Crackham magazine. Come on, guys, if you've got anything you want to say, text me 5395, call me 309 3879. I'd love to hear from you. Next up, we're talking about something a little bit controversial, veganism, so I'm sure I'll get some texts or calls then. We'll be with you in a few minutes. Stay tuned.
Hallelujah, it's Tower of Song, a tribute to Leonard Cohen, this Friday at Wine Cellar. Experience the songs of the melancholic Canadian brought to life by a great lineup of artists featuring Kirsten Warner, Caitlin Smith, Martha Louise, Will Saunders, Steve Abel, Chris Priestley, Bernie Griffin and Tony Dawn. Chuck on your famous blue raincoat for Tower of Song, a tribute to Leonard Cohen, this Friday at Wine Cellar.
And everybody knows that it's now or never.
God, did you hear Bruce's poetry? It was absolutely crack up.
Oh, that's a bit mean, Amy.
Actually, I meant the new Fleet Foxes album, Crack Up. Bruce's poetry was absolutely an intricate and resonant exploration of the self.
Whoa! Fleet Foxes are returning to NZ for 2018, and we know you want to be there. If you want a chance to win yourself some free tickets, just stay tuned to 95BFM all this week. Fleet Foxes live at the Auckland Town Hall, Tuesday, January 9th. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
Come on now, partner. Soothe an old man's soul with some of that good old down homey music.
Well, I ain't no Gene Autry, but wake me up inside. Now wake up, wake me up.
God's blood, son, cease! Damn it, Pappy. Never stray from Border Radio, you know that.
Border Radio with your alternating hosts, Bernie Griffin and Deputy Paul.
Now, baby, please don't go back to New Orleans. You know I love you so good.
She's a devil.
Border Radio, just authentic American country and blues. Sundays, 7 to 9 p.m., only on 95BFM.
The Wire.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
So in New Zealand, we farm over 30 million sheep, 7 million dairy cows and 4 million cattle. Over 100 million meat chickens, 3 million egg-laying hens and 800,000 pigs live on factory farms. We also export live animals, mainly dairy cattle, to a number of countries. But over many decades, the expansion of animal farming has transformed New Zealand's landscape. Deforestation has led to many bird species becoming extinct or endangered, and dairy farms are one of the leading causes of water degradation, with most rivers now unsafe to swim in. I spoke with Dr. John Livesey, who has a PhD from Canterbury University and worked as a scientist at Christchurch Hospital for 20 years, and we chatted about some of the leading benefits of veganism and his response to some of the criticisms that vegans receive.
Well, I think there's a lot of concern about the environment these days and global warming, and I think that is a powerful argument for becoming vegan. But in addition to that, of course, there are some health benefits, and then there's the ethical issues around using and killing animals, and the welfare issues related to, you know, keeping them in poor conditions as well. So I think those are the main drivers.
So in terms of you being a vegan, what are the sort of environmental, you know, drives?
Well, if we start with global warming, we're looking at a lot of what the dairy products we eat come from ruminants, that is cattle, dairy cows, sheep, goats, deer, and they produce a huge amount of methane emissions. In fact, sheep are the biggest methane emitters in New Zealand, and methane is a potent greenhouse gas. More potent than CO2, I think that just about everybody knows these days. And keeping ruminants is a huge contributor to New Zealand's greenhouse gas emission. And the other thing that's not quite so well known is that there are very high nitrous oxide emissions from the urine from the animals. In fact, more than 50% of New Zealand's nitrous oxide emissions are from animal urine, which gets in the ground. So, and then, of course, there's the well-highlighted problems of intensive dairying polluting water with nitrogen, phosphorus, and E. coli. And another argument is the area that is now used as pasture for the said ruminants could be instead, if everybody went in an ideal world vegan, could be reforested in forests. Forests capture about 20 times as much carbon per hectare as pasture, so we could make a big contribution to reducing the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere by reforestation of the huge proportion of land that is now just in grass, really, in New Zealand.
So I suppose for a lot of people, the environmental side is then sort of overlooked by, you know, the drive that New Zealand's economy just relies on, you know, dairy exports and meat exports, and this agriculture is what's kind of propping up our economy.
Well, absolutely. We saw that in the last election where the National Party was very against any suggestion of, for example, a water tax or serious attempts to have agriculture pay for its carbon emissions. So, yes, it's a big political issue. And I suppose people ask, well, what else would you do with the land, and especially, you know, how would you obtain protein if you didn't have dairy cows? And the answer is to get protein from legumes.
Right.
For example, Canterbury has a healthy industry growing peas for Watties and other manufacturers. The drier areas of New Zealand, like Canterbury, are very good for growing legumes, peas, beans, lentils, that sort of thing. And we get all the protein we need from a much lower area of land with much less pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. And it'd be much healthier for us because legumes are associated with better health and they have lots of fibre and that sort of thing.
You also mentioned in your blog that we, you know, perhaps as New Zealand need more economic diversity just because we're sort of relying on one thing and that's unstable for our, you know, perhaps our future.
Well, absolutely, yes. I mean, putting all your eggs in one basket, so to speak. Pun in this context, talking about veganism, is certainly not a good idea economically. We only have to have the Chinese or somebody fall out of love with dairy products.
Yes, and then all of a sudden
that's
decide
right.
They don't want any more.
That's right. But there are lots of other things land can be used for. Fruit and vegetables are not only good for the environment growing them, but are strongly associated with good health as well.
In terms of the diet for the vegans themselves, I suppose there's a lot of people that would argue that they're missing out, you know, that they're deficient in certain vitamins, things like B12, you know, amino acids, even cholesterol that's supposed to, we're supposed to have some of, you know. Can we find these in a vegan diet? Is it a livable and healthy alternative?
A number of studies have been done looking at vegan and vegetarian diets compared to omnivores. They're very difficult to do for various reasons. It's not easy to get good information, but none of the studies show that vegans have any higher death rate than non-vegans. That's good news, and reassure parents of teenagers who are thinking of becoming vegan that there's no evidence that vegans overall have worse health. A number of the studies show that vegans have, in fact, have somewhat better health. The best one, California, since the Adventist studies have shown that vegans have about a 15% lower death rate overall than non-vegans. So there are health benefits. The health benefits seem to be, as far as one can tell from the studies, mainly concentrated in middle-aged males, and that's because a vegan diet is very good at reversing heart disease, atherosclerosis. And you may recall that a little while ago, Bill Clinton famously went vegan for a while because his heart was clogging up. Vegan diets can help with diabetes. Vegans tend to be less likely to be overweight or obese. Yeah, but it's most beneficial in middle age because the young, well, the young are pretty healthy anyway. And when you get to old age, there's all sorts of diseases that are not diet-related, just sort of lurking around the corner waiting. The greatest benefit from being green. Now, on the question of what you need, vegans definitely need to take B12. There's no alternative to that. Everything else is easily obtained from a vegan diet.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
I then spoke with Luke Burrows, the managing director of Wise Boys, a vegan burger food truck, about the increasing popularity of plant-based diets and why they are so successful.
So my brother Tim and I, we built this food truck from sort of as much recycled material as we could find. So some recycled pallets, recycled corrugated iron, and we built it nearly 2 years ago and have been roaming the streets of Auckland and beyond since then, selling vegan burgers, of all things.
And did you think that that would be really popular, or were you kind of surprised by the turnout, I suppose, or the rising popularity of it?
Yeah, we had no idea if people would buy meatless burgers, but we wanted to sort of shake things up a bit. Our original idea was to try and sort of reverse the menu, so as opposed to having one token veggie burger option, you had one token meat option. But then we thought, oh, actually, let's just go completely vegan. And had no idea, did no proper market validation or anything like that. Just wanted to give it a go and make those options available for people.
In the sort of food truck, climate, I suppose, at the moment, that's sort of a rising industry in itself. Are you finding that a lot of those are vegan and that's just becoming sort of a trend?
I think everyone's realising they've got to have a vegan option now. Mm. And so there are a number of... another food truck just started a couple of weeks ago. That's a fully plant-based food truck, which is really cool. There are a couple of us who are solely plant-based. And then even the ones that aren't, almost every single one has a vegan option and is really conscious of needing to cater to that demographic now.
Mm. And you talked a little bit about, you've talked a little bit about how, you want to see more people get into this sort of reducing lifestyle. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, for us, we just became aware of the impact of eating meat and the environmental impact of the dairy industry as well, and thought, well, it's really good for us to change our consumption habits and to reduce or cut out all animal products in our diets. But it kind of is like, what if we could expand that change and show people that vegan food doesn't have to be synonymous with clean eating hashtags and little salads, And what if you could actually say, we don't need to compromise on taste or feel or enjoyment to eat a vegan diet. And so that's where we go. And we go and we sell maybe 100 burgers on a night, and we think that's 100 meals that someone's had that haven't contained animal products.
Mm.
And that sort of the net effect of that is really positive. And so, yeah, I'm all for people trying to, or just being conscious of what they consume and in all facets. So it's not just food, it's clothing, it's whatever else. But, really being conscious of that and thinking of the effects of especially what you eat and where it's come from and what are the lasting effects of it.
Yourself as as a vegan, do you find that the health benefits are what people say they are?
I have not noticed any adverse effects, and I think what it has meant for me is I've just cut out a lot of junk food. You don't get fast food very often. You don't eat all that chocolate or cheese or whatever. I don't think there's any negative health risks associated with it, as long as you're relatively diligent with it and
making sure you get all your nutrients.
Exactly. We have delicious burgers though, and I'd say to anyone who's pretty skeptical, don't knock it until you try it.
Yeah. Where can they try it?
You can just follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook.
our website has a full list of where we're going to be in the coming weeks. And we just roam around markets and events.
The Wire.
I don't know. And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM. If you have anything you want to chat to us about or any comments you want to make, feel free to text in 5395. Surely somebody's got some ideas on veganism. I'm thinking there can't be, we can't have a bunch of people listening that are thinking like, oh yeah, after that I'll become a vegan. I want to hear if you don't want to become a vegan, or maybe after listening to that, you've like, oh, maybe I do want to become a vegan. I want you to text in either vegan or not vegan. 5395. Next up, we will be talking to Nicole Wedding from Radio Adelaide about everything that's going on across the ditch. Stay tuned.
Something's wrong because my mind is fading. And everywhere I look, there's a dead end waiting. Temperature's dropping at the rotten oasis, stealing kisses from the leprous faces. Heads are hanging from the garbage man trees. Mouthwash, jukebox, gasoline. Pistols are pointing at a poor man's pockets. Smiling eyes ripping out of his sockets. Got a devil's haircut in my mind. 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 Love machines on the sympathy crutches. Discount orgies on the dropout buses. Hitching a ride with the bleeding noses. Coming to town with the briefcase blues. Got a devil's haircut in my mind. Got a devil's haircut in my mind. Got a devil's haircut in my mind. Got a devil's haircut.
Call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
It is Neighbourhood Watch. Nicole, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Kelly. How are you?
Good. We are good. We've just been talking veganism. Are you a vegan, Nicole?
I'm not a vegan. Are you a vegan?
Loosely. No, I am. For all intents and purposes, I am. But we've had a little bit of controversy there. But what is the controversy on your side of the ditch today?
There's a lot of things. Firstly, our former Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, when he was Prime Minister, he was already quite outspoken, but he obviously tempered his views a bit as Prime Minister, and now he's feeling free to...
Say what he wants.
Yeah, exactly, undermine the current government. Mm. So, show his true colours. And he was he appeared at a climate sceptic think tank in London this week, and he said things like climate change is probably doing good, and that the measures that governments are implementing to deal with climate change are like primitive people killing goats to appease the volcano god.
What was the reaction to that in this think tank?
Well, the think tank loved it. They're just full of people who like supported his views, and he knew that he was going to an audience that would be receptive. And it's quite funny, the Guardian, they were told that they couldn't go to this event because it wasn't for the media, but they later found out that like conservative newspapers were there, and parts of it were sent specifically to conservative newspapers, like, so they could have the story.
Goodness. Wonder why he's still being sent off to these things, don't you?
You do.
And you've also had a something else a little bit different, that, you know, there's a push to have robots mark English exams. Is that right?
Yeah. I was surprised by this because I would have thought that maybe maths or maybe even science would have been a better area than English to mark, because they were talking about marking creative writing.
That's odd.
Yeah, it is odd because, you know, you'd think humour and irony, things like that, would be where these robots would trip up.
Yes, and things like maths and science, which, you know, maybe some of the smaller tests and stuff that have just answers that are always the same and can be like either yes or they're either right or wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was thinking some of the, like, because the NAPLAN also has, like, year three tests and quite low, like lower year levels, and I thought that for those year levels, sure, like maths and stuff would be fine. But yeah, they're thinking about marking English with robots across all the years up to year nine.
When are they thinking of doing this?
I think they want to do it as soon as they can. By 2020, they want fully automated marking. That will be double marked by a teacher, but it's come under criticism from some, you know, quite prominent academics. This person from MIT has come out and said that he doesn't believe that automated marking is very good. It relies on, you know, very dubious methodology.
Because has this been sort of in the pipeline for quite a while now, or is this a new, you know, kind of a new government initiative?
I think it's been in the pipelines for a while now. I hadn't heard of it before, but I know that they have used automated marking in America, and that's why this academic doesn't like it very much.
Right.
Yeah.
Has come out and said so.
Yes.
Yeah, well, good on, because like, you kind of wonder what research has been done into this. I mean,
I mean, and presumably, like, the next step is to not get it double marked by a teacher.
Yes, exactly. And that's where you'd have to tread very, very, very carefully.
Exactly.
Yes. And electricity users in Victoria, South Australia and New South Wales might be able to make money by turning off their lights.
Yeah, I read in this article that this is something that has taken place in New Zealand already. I didn't even know about it.
Oh, neither did I.
Yeah.
Good to know.
I don't know if it's like the whole country or parts of it, but apparently in the United States and New Zealand, they have this system where in peak times, like during heat waves and things like that, if you, turn off your aircon or, you know, switch off pool pumps and appliances like that, you can make money. I don't know how much money it is, but the federal government wants to spend about $30 million to support the trial, and the New South Wales government is contributing $7
million. Wow.
So they're trying to avoid, like, big statewide blackouts like we had last year in South Australia.
Right, yes. I read in the article that it was $25 if you turned it, like, you know, if you turned off your lights maybe, or all your electricity for the night, which is actually not bad. You know, if you're just going to go to sleep, make $25 bucks for sleeping. It's not bad at all.
True.
Are you going to be participating in that, do you think?
Who knows? Maybe. I mean, yeah, lights don't seem like a big deal.
Yes. So. Yeah, I suppose it's all the other things, isn't it? All the little things. So this hasn't been done in Australia before? This is sort of a new initiative, I suppose?
Yeah. I mean, we've had a similar program operating in Queensland before, but I don't think there hasn't ever been a push to make it widespread.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Hopefully we see some more of that, because I think, you know, climate change is probably doing good, as Tony says. So, you know, following Tony's footsteps, let's all turn off our lights. Thank you so much for joining us, Nicole, and we will chat to you again next week.
Yes, talk to you then.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
95 BFM presents Primal Scream. Primal Scream, up close. Power Station, Friday, February 23rd. Go to powerstation.net.nz. A lucky shiny thing.
We want to have a good time.
The beauty of the fleeting and the ephemeral is so 20th century. BFM's best shows, features and interviews are now available as podcasts on RSS and Apple. Yours to cherish forever.
Welcome to 95 BFM Top 10. You're with Pearl.
Fashion.
Turn to the left.
On Land of the Woodwoo. Got lined up three songs.
Yo, 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 welcome back. It's True School.
Why?
I don't know.
Well, you're kind of a mellow beginning to the journey.
Welcome to the Saturday 2 to 4. My name is Sarah. I will be...
Greetings and welcome. This is the Rhythm Selection and it's just gone.
Never miss out again. Becasts, available now on Apple Podcasts or RSS for whatever podcatcher you're into.
You are
a decision from the ministry and the beneficiary doesn't agree with us, then they have 3 months to apply for a review of the decision. And that gets heard by what is called the Benefits Review Committee. That's a committee of 3 people that will hear the client's case. And on the other side, the investigator that did the investigation for the ministry will present their case. The panel is made up of 2 staff from the MSD and 1 layperson who comes out of the community. Well, that's the first kind of tilting of the power balance, in that 2 members of the panel, so are ministry staff, and in some cases one of those is actually an investigator themselves. It is very difficult to feel that that is an independent panel.
For a lot of beneficiaries, is there common difficulties they face in actually accessing these appeals?
The difficulty is that the panel is stacked against the beneficiary. Now, I need to say here that this is a legal requirement. This is not the ministry that's made this up. This is where you get a systemic bias against beneficiaries. Where it actually starts is that in the Social Security Act, there's only 1 section that talks about a review, and that actually specifies that 2 of the 3 panel members have to be from the ministry. If you compare that to ACC, it's actually 180 degrees the opposite. There, the legal specification is that the reviewer should not have any dealings with ACC, should be independent, and there's it's about 8 sections that describe the powers of the reviewer. So here, that's where it starts. There's, in law, there's a bias against beneficiaries.
I want to pick up on the idea here that the way that ACC is set up is the complete opposite to what we're talking about here. They're both organisations which are designed to provide money to people in a time when they cannot provide for themselves or their families. What's the government's reasoning for separating these two and having them run differently? It seems that on the beneficiary side compared to ACC, there's a lot more suspicion and there's a lot more doubt over why the money has been given out. Is this a justified suspicion, or the people that you're seeing, are they similar to those people in the situation of ACC?
The people that we see come to us with, often when they're investigated or when they have been investigated and they see they have applied for the review, what I see is that the investigation of the ministry is patchy. That the evidence that they use against the beneficiary is often, there's gaps in there. The credibility of some of the witnesses isn't there. For example, they'll use an ex-partner as a witness against a new partner, which seems fairly obvious that that is not going to be a credible source of information. The evidence that they use are records that often the beneficiary never had any control over, like the emergency department might fill out a form on a computer where the phone number of the father of the children ends up in a section that says next of kin or partner. Now, the beneficiary never had any control over entering the finer details saying, yes, he's the father of the children, but he's not living with me. So there's, I think that overall the quality of the investigations of the ministry are quite poor and quite uneven. Once you get a chance to counter that, you can see that there's gaps in there. The quality of the interviews is often, there's a lot of leading questions, there's a lot of repeated questions to witnesses till they give the right answer. It's unsatisfactory. I think it's unsatisfactory the way, in a legal sense,
If we were seeing this run in a similar organisation, if we were seeing ACC run like this, do you think there would be more public outcry?
Totally. I think so. And I think that ACC has become so good, or lots of people have got issues with ACC, but the process and the fairness of the process has, over time, is really because of the litigation by ACC claimants, has adjusted itself. And ACC now has a system where that is, in terms of natural justice and fairness, is a good system. I think that there is underlying acceptance in that it is okay to badmouth beneficiaries. Whereas I look upon it as quite different. I look upon it saying the ministry staff are public servants. In the tax department, internal affairs, they're all public servants and they have to be polite, they have to give a service, they have to be courteous. That is just part of being a public servant. And the ministry staff should behave just as if they were in internal affairs. The tax department, there's money launderers. The tax department doesn't look at everybody coming to the desk as if they're a money launderer or, you know, but with really a bad faith. You know, there's this feeling of bad faith of beneficiaries are here to rip off the system.
Do you think that that's a justified idea? Or, I mean, the people that are coming to you seeking legal advocacy and help, wanting to appeal these decisions, do you have to turn many away and say that, sorry, this isn't justified, you don't deserve this? Or the people that are coming to you generally need help and you're able to provide that?
Most people that I see that come here for help because they're investigated, I am happy to go to review and argue their case and feel that I have a significant number of things to say to the ministry where I think they got it wrong. So in most cases, I feel that there is an argument that the ministry simply has based the decision on assumptions or slightly random evidence, so that really their case is not that strong. So mostly we go there and we feel that there is a good case to be argued.
People that want to appeal a decision or an investigation seem often to find it challenging just to navigate the correct path or the correct course to achieve the outcome they want. As I understand it, only 25% of people appealing an investigation actually appear in person. What are the reasons that people find it so difficult to navigate the system?
Well, for a start off, you're asking a beneficiary that is unhappy with the department to appear in front of the department. So that's intimidating. So people that are really upset with the decision will apply for review, And come the review hearing, which might be a month or two or three, the week before they freak out, and the stress of appearing in a legal type forum shouldn't be underestimated. It's very stressful. You've got to be very organized. And the people that are successful are usually the people that are extremely organized, that understand evidence. So I think that the whole system needs to be put outside the ministry, so that somebody who wants to review a ministry decision is in another forum where they appear and the ministry appears as two equal parties, just the two parties in the hearing, so that the beneficiary can bring their case, the ministry can bring their case, then the reviewer will simply take that away and make a decision on the facts. Because the beneficiary also, in most cases, the beneficiary has to go on with the minister. They're still on a benefit. So it's not as if they can appear and then walk away, win or lose. It's a situation where there's an ongoing relationship, which has, it's another overlay in the dynamic of how hard it is to ask and to object to a decision from the ministry. It really, there really is a necessity to get a proper independent review system. And there's examples already there. There's simply no reason why the challenges to the ministry's decision cannot be treated the same as ACC. But it is because of the law. It needs a law change. So we need to knock on the door of the minister and say, you need to change this.
Trust BFM? Sure can.
That was producer Connor speaking with Simonette Boulet of Community Law Canterbury about the issue of independence in beneficiary investigation and appeal methods. A great investigative journalism piece. Sorry about having to back-traduce? Is that a word? Back-juice? I don't know. Not introduce.
It makes sense.
I don't know. But the other side of it, the opposite, post-juice, after-juice. Anyway, if you know that, please text in, 5395. Next up, Laura Chats, 14 Hours Homeless, BFM.
The Wire.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
An event to raise awareness and funding to support homeless New Zealanders, 14 Hours Homeless, will begin this evening. Participants will be sleeping out in the streets of cities around New Zealand. A senior policy analyst at the Salvation Army's Social Policy and Parliamentary Unit, Alan Johnson, spoke with me on the matter. He started by explaining the homelessness crisis in New Zealand.
Basically, what we're finding increasingly is that levels of outright homelessness, that is people living in cars, people living on the streets, is increasing to a level that I think is unprecedented in almost living memory. That's almost two generations. We've not seen this level of homelessness that we're seeing on our streets and in our car parks across Auckland and increasingly elsewhere in New Zealand. The underlying cause is effectively that we've had a government that really has paid little regard to whether or not there's adequate housing for people. It's more or less said that is the responsibility of the market, and that left to its own devices, the market sooner or later will provide sufficient housing for people. And we're seeing literally that doesn't, with what we're seeing on the streets and the car parks across this country.
So in line with our discussion on the 14 Hours Homeless Challenge, I was just wondering what kind of effect you're expecting these kinds of events to have on the state of homelessness.
Look, I think it's those sorts of things are about the experience people get, and by doing, you know, by basically sleeping rough and experiencing the everyday life of someone who is homeless permanently. We've done these things before, and last year there was a big series of events called Park Up for Homes, which was similar. A couple of thousand people who were involved in that. And what you find is that it becomes a whole lot more personal when you start to understand what someone else's life is like. So when you see someone in the streets, and if you've experienced sleeping rough yourself, I think you can have more empathy for them. But certainly, we think that part of the response we need to make as New Zealanders is to understand that response has to be a personal one, both in terms of you know, contributing money to causes like the Salvation Army, but certainly also in understanding that this isn't just statistics. This isn't just about someone on the street. This is about, you know, the people's lived lives that are diminished by what they're experiencing.
From the political policies standpoint, what policies are in place at the minute that are benefiting the state of homelessness in New Zealand?
There's very little that's improving the state of homelessness in New Zealand. Certainly the government has accepted that it does have a problem and is committing $1 million a week now to emergency housing. From what we can see, that's really just a band-aid, in a sense that the demand for those emergency housing places isn't abating and possibly is getting worse. So basically the government's buying up motels and renting out as many premises as it can to provide emergency housing. The Salvation Army is involved with those programs, but it's still not enough. And the reason it's not enough is because we're not building housing that people can afford, modest, you know, affordable housing for people on low incomes. And while we continue to ignore that issue, the problems to do with people literally being homeless will continue and possibly get worse.
And are there any political parties that you believe have good ideas to fix the state of housing?
Look, I think certainly the parties that were in opposition previously had shown a commitment to doing something about the supply of housing. Certainly, for example, the Labor Party had committed to building 1,000 state houses a year if they became the sort of the government. We think that's probably about half of what's needed in the long term. So while some of the parties have acknowledged that there's a big problem and have committed to doing something about it, the reality is that even that level of commitment, we believe, is inadequate. But certainly the opposition parties in the previous electoral term were showed some interest in addressing these issues.
So that's all my questions, but did you have any further comments you wanted to make?
Look, I just think it's important that listeners understand that, you know, that if we can't as a society ensure that everyone has an adequate housing, then we are diminished by that, and then ultimately our society goes into a sort of a decline that allows worse and worse things to happen to people, particularly children, and just to ask them to think about the personal aspects of it and what we can do personally.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
That was The Wire for Friday the 13th of October. Kia ora rawa atu. Thank you to everybody who came on the show today. We had... No, Jamie Lee. Very sad. Jamie Lee, we're having you next week, though, so stay tuned for that. But today we had Nicole Wedding, Alan Johnson, Mark Fullerton, Isabel Gledhill, Dr. John Livesey, Luke Burrows, and Simonette Boulet. A big thank you to my producers, Laura Quigstad and Connor Mercer, and news director Lillian Hanley. That was a pretty good show, guys. I feel like we covered a range of topics. We didn't get any texts, but...
I'm sad about that.
But we did get some calls. I got a call from somebody saying, if you are a vegan and you're finding it hard to find your B12, which you can't find in many things, Marmite. So you know what? There's that myth debunked.
And also got that other call warning you, if you wanted to be vegan, to avoid driving and collecting the crickets on
exactly,
the way.
Exactly, because that is not very vegan behaviour.
I'm assuming they're getting out of the car and then eating those crickets post-drive.
Exactly. Not vegans, though. Also, I think it's Friday, isn't it? So what does that mean?
Oh, the Hummus Friday.
Hummus Friday? I think it is.
I've seen a bit of hummus floating around the office today.
I did. What is hummus?
Well, what is the meaning of hummus?
Hummus is a delicious dipping...
Hummus is love.
Something. Hummus is love.
Hummus is everywhere.
Chickpeas, tahini, oil, lemon juice, salt, pepper. That's your typical hummus. Then obviously you can add some different elements to it. Today we had a sun-dried tomato pesto hummus. And we also had a...
Basil pesto.
Basil feta pesto.
Didn't quite hit the mark.
I'm saying my hummus was better though.
Some delicious hummus to be had here on the Friday Wire.
I definitely dropped the bar in my hummus selection today, guys.
That's all right.
Like, step your game
The sun-dried tomato was great. So we recommend go find the sun-dried tomato hummus.
You should also find Kelly's Instagram.
You know what? Look it up. There's an Instagram. I'm not going to say what it's called, but there is an Instagram floating around where somebody rates hummus, and it's pretty brilliant.
Anyone looking for an after-work Friday platter, that's the place to go.
That's the place to go. Thank you very much for joining us here on The Friday Wire, where we have a mix of serious journalism and banter about food at the end. Have a lovely weekend. Murray's coming up next. Enjoy your hummus. Enjoy Winston's decision making. We're waiting for it.
There'll be more hummus head before that, I'd say.
Crying in the corner about Winston.
And we will see you next Friday. More hummus, more news. Stay tuned, 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.